The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
If the opposition can't smell blood this year, we're as well pack it in, because even if Comerford's kickouts are as good as Cluxton's, every team is taking a step forward.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
The story of the UEFA European Championships on OTB Sports with Heineken, official beer partner of UEFA Euro 2020. Finally together to be rivals again. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.
Now, you're very welcome back. So this is our UEFA European Championships roadshow here on OTB Sports with Heineken, official beer partner of UEFA Euro 2020. Finally together to be rivals again. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie. We've had a brilliant evening so far. The wonderful Brian Laudrup has told us all about Euro 92, and it is an extraordinary story. It's available on all our social channels to watch back or to podcast. And I'm very happy to say we have another guest who has previewed the final with us already, and now we're going to chat to him a bit about his life and times and his Euro memories. His career, extraordinary. I'm sure you're all very familiar with it. 15 years at Rangers from 1983 through until 1998. He won just the 10 league titles. Top goal scorer in Europe, 1992. Top goal scorer in Europe, 1993, which is no small feat. And then with Scotland, 61 caps. He scored 19 goals, played at two Euro tournaments, which we'll chat about in due course, and MBE as well. That one had passed me by. Ali McCoy's not bad for the kid Alex Ferguson said was too small.
That's right. I love telling him that story every time I see him, Joe. And the last time I saw him, I think, was over at Cheltenham. You know, Sir Alex loves a day at the races, loves his horses. Well, I think it might have been just a couple of days before the first kind of lockdown. If you remember, Cheltenham went on, and I saw him down there. And the first thing I do is always remind him of that. I said, as great a manager as you are and were, I said, that was a blunder and a half.
I must say, so we'll get into your career and chat to you about your Euro memories as well, in particular, which is very much the theme of the evening. But just doing some research on you and watching various interviews that you've done, it jumps out a mile away. You're such a people person. Like, every story you seem to tell, you talk about how much you love that person and, oh, this guy's such a great fella, I have to tell you about this guy, or I got on so well with this person. It's like whoever's thrown at you, even Alex Ferguson I throw at you there, who says you're too small as a kid, you've got this lovely, warm, jokey relationship with them. And, you know, I talk to people all the time and do research all the time. I'd say more than most, I get that sense from you of someone who just loves people, loves fun, life is for living, let's enjoy ourselves. Is that a very conscious thing? Are you naturally that way? Do you get that from a parent? Why are you, I mean, it's I'm asking this like it's a bad thing. Why are you that way?
No. Do you know something, Joe? I think I get it from my mum's sister, my Aunt Chris, who sadly is no longer with us. I've never met a more bubbly, happy person, full of life, than my Aunt Christine. And that was my mother's sister. And my mother reckons that's where I get it from. She was just a bundle of fun, bundle of energy, and loved being in people's company. And I'm just the exact same. I mean, I was at my happiest every day walking into a dressing room full of my teammates who I got on well with. And if you can't enjoy that, you're seriously in the wrong job. You get into work, play football every day. And it was just an environment that I absolutely treasured and loved. And I've been very, very lucky since then, whether it's coaching, management, or indeed television or radio. As I say, I don't underestimate how fortunate I am to be doing something that I really enjoy. Mm. And if you do really enjoy it, you're as well doing it with a smile on your face. So I think that's my philosophy on it, mate.
Well, listen, it's a great way to go through life. The MBE had passed me by the way. I didn't realise that until today. And then I saw a video of you the next day walking into the Rangers dressing room with the medal on your jacket and saying, breathe it in, boys.
Well, I knew it. I thought I was going to have to attack first, right? Because I knew I was going to get pulverised the following morning at training for having this MBE. So I thought the only way to handle it was attack or be attacked. So I stuck it on my lapel and walked into the dressing room wearing it, which I don't think people that, you know, earn the MBE, I don't think it's the kind of done thing. But anyway, I decided to wear it the following morning at work. So you can imagine, you can imagine the banter in the dressing room that morning. And needless to say, I got absolutely battered.
You've had a real, I don't know even how what way to put it, a kind of a renaissance of sorts. I mean, you've been in the media for such a long time, but for the last couple of years, now I don't have ITV over here. I can't get it the way my channels are configured, right? But everyone I listen to tells me you and John Champion together on commentary is the only way to watch a game of football. This seems to have really exploded the last couple of years.
Yeah, I've been really lucky, as I say, because we'd worked together, John and I, a good few times beforehand, Joe, but they decided to put us together at the World Cup in Russia. And a lot of the lads chose to stay in the one base, whether it was Moscow or St. Petersburg. But thankfully, it was an opportunity for us to actually go and see Russia. And it was a no-brainer of a decision for myself and John. So we ended up going to games at... We had a base in Moscow, but we went to games at St. Petersburg, Sochi, Samara, Kazan, Nizhny Novgorod, all with an opportunity to go to these places where we would just never have gone before. And we got to know each other and we just really, really hit it off. And we had so much fun doing our work. And we enjoyed each other's company. And I think that transmitted itself into the commentaries as well.
Right.
Because, generally speaking, we would get to a venue maybe 24 hours before it, and we would obviously do our preparation of the game, but we would go and do a little bit of sightseeing. For example, in Sochi, we went to Stalin's place, his holiday home, his Dachan, and then we went to Kazan, we went to the mosque and things like that, went all over the place, and we genuinely enjoyed it. And it just started, it got a little bit silly at the point, because we would do these kind of trips and enjoy them at a little bit of historical value, and it started with a throwaway line when John said to me about Kazan. He said, with a nice walk about Kazan there this morning, Ali, somebody went down injured and there's a break of play, and he said, I could see you enjoyed that walk about Kazan. He said, what did you think about Kazan? And I looked at him and I said, well, I've got to be honest, you said that it hasn't half changed since it fell to Ivan the Terrible in 1428. And then that nonsense just kind of transmitted. There was a kind of expectancy. Although the serious side of the job was to commentate in the game, always has been and always will be, I think they quite enjoyed the camaraderie that we had off it as well. So, no, as I say, that was a dream ticket. The Russian World Cup was fantastic.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I've heard amazing things about the duo, so I must try and catch it somewhere or somehow. Something else I wanted to check with you. You can correct me if this is wrong. I was just mentioning to a few people you were coming on, and they said you're actually pretty popular. Maybe popular is too strong a word. You're not detested by Celtic fans. Is that right?
Well, I hope so. I really do hope so. And I hope that's the case. I think a lot of the Celtic and indeed Rangers fans could see that. I got a lot of special relationships with people at Celtic, whether it was the late Tommy Burns, who him and I were coach when a national team together, Paul McStay. We still got a five-a-side game on a Monday and a Wednesday, and McAvenny plays, and Mark Wilson that used to play with Celtic, Simon Donnelly. So I'd like to think, Joe, that there's a majority or a lot of Celtic fans can look at me and just see that I'm a Rangers man and I wanted to play for Rangers and I wanted to score for Rangers the same way that Frank McAvenny wanted to do the same with Celtic. Plus the fact, I'm hoping there's an element of when I did manage to score against Celtic, the first thing I wanted to do and the only thing I wanted to do was celebrate with the Rangers fans. That was the most important thing.
Yeah, because I saw even you carried Tommy Burns' coffin, so there's obviously a great relationship there. So if you're strolling down Glasgow City Centre and 200 yards away, you see 10 lads in Celtic jerseys, would you be crossing the road or would you think I should be okay here?
No, do you know something? I hope I don't get it wrong one Saturday. No, I'm genuinely speaking, I'm fine.
Yeah.
There'll be a bit of good good natured banter, you know, it'll come my way, I'll be in the wrong end of it, but that's fine, you just got to have a laugh. But genuinely and generally, there's 99.9%, and I mean that, there's no malice at all.
Yeah.
You know, you get a bit of stick as you would, you know, a Liverpool supporter from an Everton supporter or a Spurs from an Arsenal. There's absolutely no malice to it or no hurt to it, but 99% of the time, it's good fun. I wouldn't be crossing the road.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's the way it should be, isn't it? You know, a bit of fun like that.
Of course.
Yeah.
Listen, there's no doubt about it. I mean, back in the day, I mean, well, we would see the boys out for a beer at night. It's a lot harder for the guys now, Joe, in terms of social media and cameras and all that stuff. But, you know, we would, Old Firm games, or even when we weren't playing each other, we would see the lads out on a Saturday night and have a beer.
Right.
Whether it was Charlie Nick, but yeah, oh yeah, Charlie Nick, Mackie Avent, Frank and Peter Grant and all the boys, you know, absolutely. We'd half an hour and have a beer and a bit of crack. And I feel sorry for the lads actually nowadays that they can't do that. You know, it's a little bit of a shame, but oh, don't get me wrong, once the first whistle blew, that was it, the gloves were off.
Sure.
But once the final whistle blew, that we're all pals and we could have a beer.
If I jump into your Euros memories then, which I guess is kind of the whole point of the evening, because if I don't, the clock will get, sure, get against us. So, at 92, Sweden, you were in a group with the Germany and the Dutch. You lost those games. I mean, you've the current European and World Cup champions there, and you were in with USSR as well, and you beat them. I guess 96 for you must be the big memory, is it? Scoring that goal against the Swiss, and it's a brilliant goal as well, and beautiful setup from Gary McAllister. Your celebration I was watching, I mean, it wasn't quite Marco Tardelli, but it wasn't far off it. There was a sense of, oh my God, I can't believe I've done it. This is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. But if you look closely and you read my lips, I was actually asking Craig Brown why he didn't start me in the England game. No, but I wasn't 100% fit. But no, there's no doubt about it. That would certainly be my happiest memory of both tournaments. Would be the strike against Switzerland, Joe. But actually, Euro 92, believe it or not, we played really, really well. We were unlucky. We lost a goal in the last, I think, the last 10 minutes. To Holland. Bergkamp scored, they beat us 1-0, and then we played ever so well against the Germans. We really did. We should have got something out of that game as well. Ended up getting beat 2-0, and then we comfortably beat the old Soviet Union. I think they were known as the CIS at that time.
Yes.
The Combined States. But it's typical, and it is very, very typical. There's always glorious failure involved somewhere. So 92, we won the last game 3-0, but didn't qualify. And then 96, we took it to a new level. We get knocked out on goals scored, which to be fair to us was a new one. We hadn't not qualified by that way or that fashion ever before. But no, the Euros, fantastic to be involved. You know, just wonderful when you think about it. Sweden, and I was listening earlier on to Brian there. We played, I think, our opening game in Gothenburg. I think they won the tournament in Gothenburg.
Yes.
We played the opening game against Holland and Bergen. The whole tournament was fantastically and well run, as it was in England. We had a brilliant base in England. We stayed at Stratford-upon-Avon, which was a wonderful place, lovely training camp. And then we started that one really well. We got a draw against the Dutch. Opening game, nothing each, and we played ever so well. We were hanging on. We carried a little bit of luck. I can remember John Collins punching one off the line and getting away with it. But we did okay. And then the England game was the one where we could have and probably should have maybe got something out of it. But for the brilliance of Gascoigne with his goal, and then as it would happen, we beat the Swiss, but it wasn't enough. But no, certainly memories of the Euros playing for your country, they're just fantastic.
We were talking about Paul Gascoigne in a separate piece with Brian Laudrup, and you were both sharing some lovely stories about him. Interestingly, you have his jersey from that 96 game.
I do. And it's another story, Joe, that just sums Gascoigne up, you know, incredible, because I'd said to him, I'd just my first young boy, I think he was a wee fella, he was only a baby at the time. I think Stuart McCall was the same. and he promised both of us his jersey from the game. So I know he's promised Stuart knows he's promised me, and we're not bothering at all, you know, because we know what Paul's like. We're just thinking, you know, he'll do something, he'll find a way, or, you know, we're not that bored. Anyway, I'm going down the tunnel at half-time. It's nothing each in this Scotland-England game. So you can imagine, Joe, there's bedlam, absolute bedlam going about. It was the old Wembley down the tunnel at half-time. And Gascoigne runs by me. And he runs towards the Scottish dressing room and he shouts to Stuart, Stuart! Now, this is taking place at half-time and he's on his way to his own dressing room. Stuart turns round, he takes off his jersey, throws it to Stuart and says, tell Coyste he could have a one in the second half. Wow. You know what I mean? And it's amazing. I mean, the guys, we're halfway through one of the most important matches in our career, all of our careers, and he's thinking about other people, and it just kind of sums him up. And absolutely, I do have a lovely photograph, Joe, taken at, just right at the end of the game, where we're kind of embracing each other, we're handing over each other's jersey, and I just said to him, what a goal. We'll be watching that for years to come, and I just wish you all the best. And that was it. And to be honest, they probably should have won it that year.
Yeah. God, that's amazing, that halftime story. Because even I know Alan Green on Five Live at that very moment was saying how poor Gascoigne had played in the first half. So he would have been within his rights to be distracted. That's amazing. And I know I read you said that, so he returns to a Rangers dressing room, obviously, for the following season. He'd be within his rights to walk in and say, boys, what about that goal every 5 minutes? But it was almost the opposite.
Yeah. He didn't mention it. We actually forced it. It was a funny story. Weeks and weeks later, for a laugh, we tried to recreate it in the dressing room. As you do, a rolled up pair of socks. But genuinely, when he came in, you know, he never mentioned it, Joe. And I've got my own theory on that. I'm not saying it's right, but I've got a feeling about it, and I feel quite strongly about it. I think even Gascoigne was... Now, I'm loath to use the word embarrassed, right? I don't think he was embarrassed, but I think he was certainly conscious of the fact that the goal was one of extreme quality, you know, that we would watch again. Well, there you are. I mean, 25 years later, whatever it may be, it's been constantly been on the television, and rightly so. So I think he was conscious of it, so much so he didn't mention it to us in terms of giving us a little bit of stick. Whereas I honestly believe if, for example, Alan Shearer had hit one and it hit the post and come back and Gascoigne had tapped it in from 2 yards, I think there's every chance he might have made a life a complete misery for his remainder of his period at Rangers. But I just think he was conscious, as I say, not embarrassed, but conscious of the quality of the goal. And he thought, well, no, I better just leave this alone a wee bit. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it was amazing, really.
That's interesting. As in, it would almost be somewhat boastful for him to mention it. It was that great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And he never did. He never did. Mind you, I've got to say, we were privy to him scoring some quite unbelievable goals. And I really mean unbelievable goals in his period at Rangers. The one obviously, against ourselves at Wembley, was a mark of genius. And as I say correctly, gets shown on a regular basis. But believe me, Joe, he scored some frightening goals for us, you know, up in Scotland for Rangers. Amazing.
I can only imagine. I mean, it must have been a privilege to see some of them. And you were saying in that chat with Brian, by the way, not to turn this all into a Paul Gascoigne chat, although he has a habit of almost...
He does, doesn't he?
grabbing the moment a bit, doesn't he? But you were saying maybe that could have been the best football of his career. He was happy and at home and obviously very pally with yourself and others, and maybe you got the best out of him then.
I really believe it. I genuinely believe it. I mean, He is, along with Brian, one of the most talented players I've ever played with and ever saw and trained with every day. But there was a happiness about him away. Paul Gascoigne was always at his happiest, Joe, when he had a ball at his feet, you know, when he was on the training ground or on the football park. But I could sense a real happiness in his life outside, away from it, which I'm not sure he always had, whether it was in Italy or in North East England or London. because up here, you know, it can be manic, as you know, with Rangers and Celtic. It can be very focused and crazy at times. But there are lots of places you can escape to, particularly if you enjoy fishing and enjoy the country, which Paul did. So, I mean, many's the time he would genuinely, he'd be up at, I don't know, crack of dawn, five in the morning, and there was a little loch, maybe, I don't know, 10 minutes from his house in the village, next village to me, and away he would go, and he'd fish for 3 hours before training. He'd come in, do his training. And another thing you might be aware of, Joe, he was an absolute beast of a trainer. Oh, dear me. I mean, he worked as hard as anybody I've ever trained with, whether it was in the gymnasium or whether it was hitting free kicks or whether it was taking penalties or whether it was just running. He worked incredibly hard. He would get his work done and then he'd be away again. As I say, and he loved his life up here. He would go fishing. Everybody loved him. There was always a seat at anybody's dinner table, whether it was our own dinner table, myself, or whether it was a manager, Walter Smith, or even Brian's, or Ian Durant's. You know, he was always 100% welcome. And everybody loved him, particularly the kids. Everybody absolutely loved him. But he was a real, real hard-working, talented player.
Ali, I mentioned in your introduction top goal scorer in Europe 1992 and in 1993, which is a phenomenal feat. And I know in 93 you had an injury and missed a couple of games at the end of the season, making it all the more impressive. So when it came to goal scoring, it's probably a difficult thing to explain, as in how do you do it? I'm sure it's all manner of anticipation and staying cool and probably many other things. Can you give us an insight into how you did it, how you scored so many goals? Were there certain principles that someone taught you or that you just understood yourself or figured out which served you really well? Or is it very difficult for you to explain how you went about your business?
It's not very difficult, Joe, because what I used to do, I was fortunate enough to have a sense of where to be, you know, and as much where not to be at certain times. And it was my son, funnily enough, the other day, he showed me a goal I scored against Leeds United in the European Cup before it was actually Champions League, first Champions League. And we got a corner. And he said, "What made you do that, Dad?" And it's when the ball comes across, and I think it's either Richard Goff or David McPherson goes to head it. I don't look at the ball and I'm not looking at where the ball is. I just run kind of 2 yards away from the defender, again behind him, and come out the other side of him. And lo and behold, the header comes in, the keeper makes a save, and I got a tap in. And I think there's a lot of people, and it genuinely doesn't bother me at all. I would smile at it. They would say, "Look, there's that jammy so-and-so with another tap in." But you don't appreciate maybe what happens a split second before it. And I was just lucky enough to have a sense of where to be, and probably just as importantly, if not more importantly, when to be there. Because timing is probably, you don't want to arrive early, you don't want to arrive late, you've got to arrive at the correct time. And I did work hard on finishing as well, you know. And the most important thing, and it's an easy thing to say, it's an obvious thing to say, but you know, you did attempt to hit the target. And there would be different levels of finishing exercises that we would do, some easier than others. And it was always important that even at the difficult opportunities, when I say difficult opportunities, I mean when the ball came at you in a kind of uncomfortable fashion, that you had to keep it down and hit the target and make the goalkeeper work. And that was just something I was always very, very conscious of. As I say, once you got in a little bit of the half yard. But I need to say to you, Joe, when you're playing in a side with Brian Loudrup, you know, you're playing in a side with Paul Gascoigne, you're playing in a side with, you know, the late David Cooper and Ian Durant, who were unbelievably gifted players. And dare I say it, with the exception of Gascoigne, probably the three of them that I've mentioned took as much pleasure, if not more pleasure, in creating goals than they did in scoring them. You were always going to get your fair share of opportunities to score, mate.
God, it's amazing how strong Scottish football was then. So, I mean, I'm sure you're asked, were you ever tempted to go south or to go away? But when you've got players like that around you and you love the club, I don't suspect you were overly tempted.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's obviously a question I get asked an awful lot. You know, do I have any regrets? And I genuinely don't, Joe. I don't have any regrets at all. And there's a couple of reasons for that. You touched on them. The first one is I was playing for the club, you know, that I grew up supporting as a kid, you know, when you're a wee boy. And I liken it to Paul McStay at Celtic, who is a man I've got a quite unbelievable respect for and a great friendship with. He's over in Australia now, Paul, with his family. And my mother and Mrs. McStay used to sit together at every Scotland game. And people say to me, you know, Paul McStay should have left Celtic, you know, to further his career. And that's all very fit and well. But Paul McStay, you know, loved playing for Celtic and Celtic was his team. So I've got nothing but the utmost respect for somebody like that. To a certain degree, Shearer was the same with Newcastle. He had an opportunity to go to Man City because he wanted to play with Newcastle. And that was the same with me, at Rangers. Plus the fact, I've got to be brutally honest, for a period when I was at Rangers, I believed we were the best team in Britain. You mentioned they were not Leeds United out of the Champions League, who were the English champions at that time. Mm. But even before that, clubs get banned from Europe. I mean, we had Graham Souness playing. He was player manager. And the first thing he does is sign the England captain, Terry Butcher, and the England goalkeeper, Chris Woods. And then all of a sudden, we've got England right back, Gary Stevens. We've got England midfielder, Trevor Stephen. We've got Trevor Francis. We've got Ray Wilkins. I mean, players of the highest quality. And, you know, as I say, we're very fortunate enough to be doing well, winning domestically. And, you know, I think with a look the other day, we did okay in Europe. We could have done better, but I think we get knocked out the European Cup Champions League by at least six times by teams that won it. Mm. So, you know, we're doing okay. But no, I did have one or two opportunities. And, you know, Everton were interested at one point, and there was one or two interests from German clubs.
Yeah.
But no, I don't regret it at all, Joe. Not one bit.
So 1983 is when you made your debut, and 15 years there through until 98. You're part of the nine in a row side, obviously. Graeme Souness, you mentioned, comes back as player-manager in 1986 from Sampdoria. He's 33 years of age there. He's player-coach. I've been in his presence a few times. It won't surprise anyone to hear, just watching him as a player and on TV, he has a presence. He, you know, you're aware he's in the room. He's got something about him. So I'm just so curious to hear about 33-year-old Souness, player manager at Rangers that time.
he was unbelievable. I mean, the first thing I've got to say to you, what a football player, Joe. Dear me, what a player. And I think even Graham, I take that back. Graham wouldn't admit it. He probably had his best years behind him by the time he came to Rangers. Obviously, his best years probably at Liverpool and indeed in Italy.
Yeah.
But the first thing that we were getting, well, clearly we were getting a new manager, but he was a player manager. And you're right, he carried a presence. But what a football player we were getting on the pitch as well. Somebody, I've never played with MD quite like Graham. And the respect, Joe, he knew what the game needed, you know. And by that, I mean, he knew whether he needed to tackle somebody. He knew whether he needed to slow the game down and take the sting out of it. He knew whether he needed to rile the crowd up, our own crowd or the opposition crowd. He knew if somebody in the opposition needed a harder tackle than normal, shall we say. He just knew his game management was by far and away the best that I've ever seen or ever played with. As I say, he was an incredibly talented football player, but he knew just what the game needed and he was capable of giving the game that. And then he came up and the whole place just went crazy, man. I mean, Scottish football, it just turned into the biggest helter-skelter roller coaster, and it was effectively just get yourself strapped in because this is going to be some ride for a few seasons, and that's exactly what it was. I mean, to the point, I remember his first game against Hibs at Easter Road, where 21 of the 22 players get booked after after the game. He gets sent off, and then the SFA looked at it and booked for the day, apart from Alan Ruth, who was the Hibs goalie at the time. There's a lovely shot of this free-for-all in the middle of the park, and Ruffy's leaning against his post because he couldn't be bothered. It's too far for him to run to the halfway line. But that was the kind of thing that it kind of took off, and it was amazing. It was certainly an incredibly exciting period in Scottish football.
Yeah, box office. And was he, I mean, sorry, this is a stupid way of asking this question, but take it as it is. Was he a good manager?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know something, and a couple of things. You only appreciate, you know, how good a manager is as time goes by, and being a coach and a manager myself, you know, because he left me out a few times.
Right.
And of course, at that period, I'm thinking, he's out of order. It's his fault. It's nothing to do with me, because I'm all right. But then when you look at it and I look back and I say, he was doing the right thing. And do you know something? It benefited me. Absolutely benefited me when he left me out, because it gave me a challenge. And it gave me a wake-up call. But also, you know, as I say, he knew the game. Mm. He knew the game inside out. Mm. And as a manager and as a coach, top class.
Right. The Irish football team, in some of their practice matches, do a thing, which is the dubs, as in people from Dublin. The dubs against the Colchis. The Colchis being people outside of Dublin. And, yeah, you know, it gets tasty, I'm sure. So, you know where I'm going with this. You mentioned the English contingent at Rangers. So, I mean, Lord knows why, because it seems like a terrible idea, but you'd have the Scots against the English. And
honestly, we used to play them every Friday. And I'm not kidding you, what a team they had, right? Butcher, Roberts, Woods, you know, Wilkins. And Souness used to play with them, Joe, right? And it used to drive us mental.
Why did Souness play with the English?
Because he reckoned he needed to take the numbers up, right? Okay. For the seven sides, whatever it was at the training on the Friday. But we'd rather have played 8-6. There was no way any of us were going to play with England. There's just no way, of course. He sticks the hand up, I'm playing with England. So, and the bizarre thing was, Joe, they couldn't beat us on a Friday. They couldn't beat us. We used to, Durante, myself, David Cooper, Stuart Monroe, Jimmy Nicol used to play with us. And for some reason on a Friday, they couldn't beat us. Anyway, one Friday, we're playing away and we're about four or five up, right? So we start all that ole, you know, the passing and flicking it and all this. And I'm watching Souness, Joe, and he's getting angrier and angrier and angrier. So the ball gets played into Vigerante, who takes a touch, and Souness comes in. Oh my God. A tackle. Well, I'm saying oh my. You've seen some of his tackles. This was an oh my. It's a Graham tackle.
Yeah.
So Vigerante at that point was really lightweight. And I don't know if you remember those weebles, the wee dogs, the weeble, they wobble, but they don't fall down. Mm. Well, he put Vigerante down, and like a weeble, Vigerante jumped back up, put his foot in the ball, and said straight to Graham's face, "Is that your best?" Right? To which Graham went, "No," he said. "As a matter of fact, it's not." He said, "This is." And he belted him one in the chin. Right? Now, what followed can only be described as madness, right? I've come flying in. I'm dying to get a punch at Souness, right? Headlock. Jimmy Nicol's rolling about with Graham Roberts. Walter Smith, meanwhile, is running about with a ball under his arm, blowing a whistle, going beep, beep, beep. So it's carnage in the Rangers training ground. And we walk over. Eventually, it all calms down. I'll never forget it. We're playing Dundee United the next day. So there's two sets of seven-a-side players walking across back to Ibrox. We're not talking to each other, right? So we're eventually in the dressing room, and there's no Souness. So we're all sitting there saying, I wonder what he's going to say here. I mean, he's going to go crazy here. We're Friday before Dundee United. We're all rolling about the training ground, you know? So anyway, next minute, a door gets kicked in, and he walks in. And before I lift my head and look at him, he says, I'll tell you right now, he says, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Right? He says, that's the spirit, he said, that's exactly what I'm looking for. I lifted my head, right? I've got a fillet steak in my eye, covering a big black eye. Ian Durant's got a knife pack on his knee, right? And this is exactly what he's looking for. And to make matters worse, the D United beat us 3-2 the next day.
Oh, man.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I love that you said there you were trying to get a shot in at Souness. You should count yourself lucky you never landed that shot.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't be here to tell the story, I know that. I can tell you, I can categorically tell you right now, I would not be here to tell the story.
To jump forward, actually, because I don't want to not ask you about this. I mean, boyhood fan, legend player, and then you get the honour of becoming manager. And so you'd been Walter Smith's assistant, and, you know, he let you do cup games, you know, and mentoring and, you know, getting you ready for this job, and you take the job, and, man, timing's everything, isn't it? And financial doomsday arrives. Yeah. I saw an interesting quote from you, Ali. You were talking about the whole experience, and you said, looking at me, you have to say it was affecting my health, which sounds extreme enough. Yeah. So what was that whirlwind like?
It was madness. It was absolute carnage, Joe. It was... Like I said to you, when you talk about goal scoring, timing is everything. Mm. And that was the case, you know, for management, with myself at Rangers. It was absolutely the dream job, but there could not have possibly been a worse time. That said, in many ways, I look back on it and kind of, you know, masochistically, I'm quite happy that I was in charge, and I say a Ian Kenny around me, because I think it's safe to say the people in charge knew the club and without doubt had the club's best welfare at the top of the priority list. There was people at the club, without doubt, who didn't have that, but they certainly weren't involved in the playing staff or the management. And it really was tough. I mean, I remember the day we were told we were into administration. We were down watching the kids through in Edinburgh at Hibs training ground, and it was a shock to the system. We were half expecting it, but it was still a shock to the system. But like all great clubs, and I absolutely include Celtic in this, and top football clubs, the supporters rally round. That's what they do. In times of need and in times of pressure and stress, you know, the people that matter rally around. And that was the case. The supporters rallied round in an incredible fashion. I mean, we all know what the supporters in Glasgow are like in terms of their love of football and their commitment to their clubs. It's absolutely amazing. And that was really required. And I remember one of the times we were playing Stranraer, Joe, and there was 50,000 in the stadium. And I turned to Kenny and Ian and I said that, you know, that there is the reason that we'll be all right. You know, it might not be tomorrow, it might not be 3 weeks from Tuesday, it might not be next year, the year after, but we'll be all right when you've got support like that. So as I say, it was a dream ticket, but just a nightmare time, mate.
Yeah, I can imagine. Was it Division 3 you dropped down to?
Yeah, bottom one, Division 3.
Yeah.
I mean, we were going to places. We were going to places that even I was looking for on the map, to be honest with you. We were going to, you know, Annan and Berwick and Elgin and Peterhead. And I remember the first game was up in Peterhead. And I'll have to explain this line to you, but we're playing Peterhead away. And we'll come into Peterhead in the team bus. And you've got no idea. I mean, it was like the circus coming to town. There was grannies out holding kids and wains and waving, and there was big marquees up for people having lunch. It was amazing. And we came into Peterhead, and I turned to Durante and I said, Ian, always the fair idea that you and I would end up in Peterhead. I said, but this isn't exactly how I saw it. Now, I'll just explain the joke to you. Peterhead is the high security prison in Scotland. And I said to Durante, I had a fair idea we'd end up here. But this wasn't exactly how I saw it.
Yeah.
But we went to some places, and I've got to say, the experience will stay with me for the rest of my life. There was something magical and humbling about the whole process, and indeed, maybe even therapeutic. And as I say, it wasn't where we wanted to be, and it wasn't ideal. But we had to grasp it and get our heads around it. And it was, it might be a bizarre thing to say, but it actually was a wonderful experience.
And when you said that line about looking back at times, you have to say it was affecting my health. Was that just sheer stress?
Yeah, yeah. And it was just, and at the end, I was going to one game. I can't remember. It was a game at Ibrox. And it was my wife, Jo. She said, I was upstairs getting ready, putting the collar and tie on. And I just came up, and she came up to me and she said, do me a favour. And I said, what is it? She said, go and have a look at yourself in the mirror. And I did. And quite frankly, I was horrified at what I saw looking back. And I thought, oof. Mm. I thought, that's not right, you know. And she said, she just looked at me and kind of shrugged her shoulders. And I thought, no, there's far more important things, you know. So, yeah, there's no doubt it was affecting my health. And, you know, particularly when you look at pressure that managers are under, but I think particularly, certainly in Scotland, Old Firm managers, I mean, I could so feel for Neil, what Neil was going through last year, because I knew, you know, people can imagine what he's going through, but I knew what he was going through. So, it can be tough.
Yes. On the Old Firm thing, it's true now, but certainly in your day as well, it was so intense and tackles were flying and the atmosphere was raucous. Were there players who... they mightn't have broadcasted, I suppose, to the world, but who probably didn't like those games, didn't look forward to those games, didn't enjoy them? Or did you sort of have to thrive in that kind of environment to play for those clubs?
Yeah, absolutely. You couldn't have survived, Joe. There's absolutely no way you could have survived playing with either of the Old Firm, either Rangers or Celtic, if you couldn't handle the occasion of an Old Firm match. You know, and there have been, I would imagine, I don't doubt about it, there's been players who haven't handled it, but, you know, they wouldn't get the opportunity to do it more than once, twice, three times. You have to have something in your makeup that can make you handle that situation. Because, you know, I don't care what anyone says, it's still the most passionate game that I've been involved in and probably I've seen. I'm not saying it's got the quality of some Liverpool Evertons or some Arsenal Spurs or certainly Milan. I'm not saying for a minute it's got, you know, always have the quality of that. But in terms of the passion, the tension, the excitement, everything about it, and the fans play an absolutely massive, massive part in that. There's no doubt about that. And I also think it's been a crying shame. Clear there's been no fans because of COVID. I get that. But even when there was, I think there was pettiness, to be honest with you, between the two clubs. You know, not letting supporters from other clubs into away games. And I always think to myself, you know, they should bang their heads together, because that's what makes the game as much as anything. It's the Celtic fans coming to Ibrox. It's the Rangers fans going to Celtic Park. It's just it's a wonderful game. The one game that I've not been to in my life that I'm dying to go to, Joe, is the Boca Juniors River Plate game in Argentina. That's the one I hear so much about. And I've watched it on YouTube, same as yourself. I love football. And that's the game I would want to go to more than anything. But certainly in terms of the Derby match, the Rangers-Celtic game, something special. If you guys like Souness saying it, you know, who's played in games, big games all over the world, and Henrik and boys and that, you know, world-class players saying that, then you've got to take that as fair.
Mm. And did it spill into the Scotland camp ever? I suspect you've half answered this when you're talking about if you bump into the Celtic players in a night out, you'd have a drink for half an hour.
It's amazing.
So.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing, Joe. No, never. I mean, and I don't even mean, I'm looking back trying to think, maybe once or twice. I mean, never. Never. We used to sit with the boys all the time. Our table would always be our first getting to the Scotland team, Danny McGrain and Big Roy Aiken, Paul McStay. We'd all sit at the same table with Coop, myself, you know, and Durante. And then later on, you know, whether it was, you know, John Collins or Tam Boyd or Tosh McKinley and the boys, never, ever any problems that, funnily enough, look as though there were with some England squads, an England team.
I was just going to say, I mean, in England at least you had the release valve of a few different clubs. Celtic and Rangers, just the only two. You could imagine it would be even more problematic. It's amazing that that never spilled over.
It really is. I've been reading reports of whether it was, Rio was talking about, you know, the Liverpool players, that saying the Man United players, there wasn't any. You've got no chance if that's the case. Absolutely no chance. But I've got to say, maybe it is due to the real passion and attention between the Old Firm, the Rangers Celtic games, that there really was a massive healthy respect between the players. And I mean that, I genuinely mean that. When we went away with Scotland, we used to have a giggle and a laugh and, you know, we got on really, really well. And perhaps that's one of the reasons. Listen, we're no international match winners, but we were qualifying for World Cups, we were qualifying for European Championships. As I say, you know, we were doing something right. We're World Cup 86, 90, and things like that. European Championships 92, 96, and World Cup 98. So at that time, you know, as I say, we were successful in terms of qualifying for major championships. And I think a lot of it would be down to the fact, as I say, it was a squad. And I look at Gareth's squad just now, and I can see they've got a proper squad, you know. And I look at the Irish squads, you know, back in the day with Jack, and I love talking to Andy Townsend, a great pal of mine, and I speak to Andy all the time, and he says to me the exact same thing, you know. He didn't think they were the best team in the world, but I tell you what a spirit and what a camaraderie they had. And as I say, I don't think that necessarily, well, it doesn't guarantee success, but it certainly helps, there's no doubt about it.
You mentioned all those World Cups. I would have you down as unlucky not to have been there in 86 under Ferguson and certainly 98 under Craig Brown.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the Fergie story. It's another thing I dig him up about. I got a phone call in 86 in the morning at Ibrox, and it was Jock Wallace was the manager at the time, and I could hear him arguing with Fergie, right? And then I walked into the office and he kind of threw me the phone, Big Jock. You don't know if you're aware of Big Jock. Big Jock was a very hard man as well.
Right.
And he said, he's no taking you, talk to him. And he hands me the phone and Sir Alex is on it. That's just how it went. He said, he's no taking you, talk to him. So Fergie came on and said, you've been doing well, blah, blah, blah. He says, but I'm not taking you. He said, but if MD pulls out the squad, you'll be first in. So I don't need to tell you, Kenny pulls out the squad the following day and he pulls Stevie Archibald in.
Well, do you know what? It's so funny you say that. We have Pat Nevin as a regular in our show and I've just been reading his new book and I think he told Nevin he'd be first in as well.
That's magic, isn't it? That is absolutely magic. And then in 98, I mean, dear me, I'd scored in the cup final. And that's without doubt the biggest disappointment in my career. I was in tears. I literally was in tears when I never went to France in 98. But anyway, that Craig Brown has since said, he said publicly at a dinner that it was a mistake, but which, you know, I appreciated. But the water had gone under the bridge by then. I remember the devastation at not going to that one. But hey, that's life, isn't it?
Sure is. I mean, to get to three major tournaments is pretty good going in anyone's book, isn't it? Do they live up to expectations? Are they really enjoyable experiences? Because sometimes, you know, you can hear teams saying, oh, look, boredom and just sitting around and it all got in on top of us. Not for you.
Yeah, no. I loved every one of them. I loved Italian IT this year, Euros 92, 96. They were brilliant because I think more so nowadays than ever before, you know, I'm not sure. Yeah, it's nearly impossible to get bored because there's that many things going on. Whether it's, the boys do the PlayStations now and they've got videos and Netflix and you can, you know, go for a walk, go for a swim, whatever it may be. There's always something you can do. So we were never bored. Plus, I think, like I said beforehand, I think it's very important that if you've got a good squad, then you will travel well and your base camp will be good. That is vitally important. I really think it is. So, no, I enjoyed every minute of the experiences of the major tournaments.
Ali, life now. We see on the media, What are you doing with the rest of your time? Are you busy? Do you take things pretty handy? What's life for you these days?
Do you know, life's great, Joe. I need to say to you, I watch my boys playing football now most weekends, and I absolutely love it. I can't tell you. I'm riddled with guilt with the older ones because I never got a real chance to see them growing up and playing football, but just because of work commitments. So I vowed I wasn't going to make the same mistake with the younger ones, and I love my Saturday and a Sunday. I go and watch. I mean, I'll take in probably 5-6 games on a Saturday and a Sunday, whether it's kids' football, and then I'll maybe be working in the afternoon, Saturday or a Sunday. So the football is still, it's my life, but at the same time, I play my golf. I manage to get a bit of time for golf and things like that. In fact, I need to come over your way again and get some golf, because the last time I was over, I played, it was fantastic. I mean, Ireland's obviously very much like Scotland, and some of the best links courses going, so yeah. I do enjoy my golf. So still working hard within football, but making sure I've got time to enjoy it as well, mate.
Good. It's the way to do it, I suppose, isn't it? There's no point working too hard.
No. All work, no play. That's not the answer. You should know that.
And so you've no great itch to get back into professional management?
No, I'll be honest, I miss the day-to-day. I do miss out in the park with the lads, training and coaching and as I say, taking sessions. But at the same time, you know, it is, and it's been well documented, if you're in that side of things, you know, you're away in the morning, you're not getting back till late at night, and your family life can be virtually non-existent, to be honest with you. So I would never say never, but I'm quite enjoying the balance of where I'm at this moment in time, Joe.
Yeah, very good. And where's home these days? Are you up still in Glasgow?
Yeah, mate. I'm in a little village, 10 minutes from Glasgow Airport. It's the best. I wouldn't move, mate. I, my life's up here. My kids are at school up here. Everything's great. And as I say, if I need to get down the road, I'm 10 minutes from Glasgow Airport. And Glasgow Airport's fantastic. You can fly anywhere, absolutely anywhere nowadays.
Very good. Well, listen, great to chat to you. And it was great to have you on with Brian earlier on as well. So, Ali McCoist, enjoy the final on Sunday. And listen, when you're over playing golf, we'll try and nab you and bring you into studio or do some events sometime with you.
I would love that. I'll make sure, because I'll be over soon. I can guarantee you that.
Very good. Ali McCoist, thank you. Great to have Ali McCoist with us. So that is our UEFA European Championships roadshow on OTB Sports with Heineken, official beer partner of UEFA Euro 2020. Finally together to be rivals again. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie. Thanks again to Ali McCoist. You can watch back that full interview or podcast it on all our social channels or wherever you get your podcast from. And if you missed it, we had Ali and Brian Laudrup on earlier on having a chat, and there was some good stuff in that as well. And then Brian chatted to us. I guess the theme of the evening was about the European Championships. Brian was chatting to us about Euro 92, which was brilliant as well. It's an amazing story, as you can imagine. So that's us done. We'll see you very soon.
The story of the UEFA European Championships on OTB Sports with Heineken, official beer partner of UEFA Euro 2020. Finally together to be rivals again. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.